Kamenetsky Brothers Lando Lakers Podcast. Brian Kamenetsky, Andy Kamenetsky, co-host of the Lando Lakers blog, coming to you on Tuesday. Andy, that's July 23rd to you and me. Only days after Lakers co-owner Jim Buss announced to the world that Kobe Bryant is basically healed from his Achilles surgery.
Yeah, he actually
said he's good to go.
If he were a betting man, and we all know he is because we know that the father that he comes from, the man liked to gamble, the late and great Dr. Jerry Buss. If he were a betting man, he would bet a lot of money on Kobe Bryant being available for the preseason coming back from his Achilles injury.
Yeah, I know. I think what he meant was, you know, Kobe, nobody rehabs like Kobe. Nobody takes better care of his body. Nobody finds cutting-edge medical treatment like Kobe Bryant does.
Nobody takes people believing he can't do it as more of a personal challenge to come back.
And it's just, you know what? After all these years, I would never doubt the guy. He's aiming for opening day, and I just, who am I to bet against him? That's what he meant.
However,
yeah, what he said was something that's going to make people think that Kobe might be coming back.
Yeah, so it's a little bit more expectations than I think you want for a fan base that's gone through, shall we say, a tremendous letdown from last season. I think, generally speaking, not to mention you might be actually creating a perception that Kobe is further behind in his recovery.
Yeah, it'd be amazing if training camp comes around, Kobe's not back on the floor, and everybody's like, well, what's the delay?
Why is he not back before the 6 months minimum expected? Because if he comes back for the preseason opener, people should realize that's ahead of the 6 months minimum that he was required to be out.
Or expected to be out. I mean, technically speaking, there is no requirement. You're allowed to play whenever you want. You know, so it's one of these things. It's sort of the continuing education of Jim Buss as he speaks publicly. How to learn how to say things that are uninteresting. Learn to be more like Mitch Kupchak. He hasn't quite gotten the hang of it yet, but he's trying. It's tough because you can't get out there and speak. They need him to talk more to people. They need him to be more accessible. But you can't do that without occasional missteps. Fortunately, this one comes in the off season and is relatively inconsequential. I was doing some work for Time Warner this weekend, and you know, an interesting question kind of came up because the Lakers, after all this free agent signings, and they've done a lot of stuff, and they've reshaped the roster in a lot of different ways, in ways that are probably, you could certainly argue, more flexible than what they had last year. It begs the question, if the season started today, who's your starting lineup? Both with Kobe available for opening day and then, you know, without. I mean, we all assume he's not going to be ready right at the beginning. So you have two different lineups, one without Kobe, one with Kobe. So let's figure out, you know, it's mid-July. Who's our starting lineups? I think we can both agree, whether Kobe plays or not, Steve Nash starts at the point.
Assuming he's healthy.
Right. It's true. Being optimistic. And Pau Gasol is the five.
Assuming he's healthy.
Because neither one of us are going to make Pau play the four again.
No.
He's going to be the five.
On general principle, even if Pau still ends up parked in the high post constantly, I'm going to label him the center, just like we all label Tim Duncan a four,
right,
even though we know he's a five.
He and Chris came, and they're going to play on the floor. There will be times when they're on the floor together, but I'm not making Pau do that from the get-go. It's one thing to do it for Dwight Howard.
He is El Cinco.
Right. It's another thing to do it for Chris Kamen.
He just got here.
Right. All right. But who's your starting two in the lineup without Kobe?
Jody Meeks.
All right.
Who's yours?
Steve Blake.
Okay.
I'll go first. I like what, you know, obviously Blake played very well in tandem, sort of that two point guard lineup.
Well, he was part of that 28-12 powerhouse.
He was. That was I look back on that. I'm just like, man, that was really the start of something.
I can't believe Dwight Howard left that.
And you, especially with who I'm going to put at the three, you need some ball handlers on the floor. I don't like the idea of Nash being the only guy available who handles the ball, because we saw what happened last year. Teams start crowding him. They start blitzing him. He doesn't quite have the hop anymore to get out of some of those situations. So a second ball handler, a second floor spacer, I think is a big deal.
That makes sense. I would actually like to have Blake, though, running the second unit, if nothing else, until I see evidence that Farmar runs it well, because I know D'Antoni liked the way Blake often ran the offense.
Still,
in Nash's absence,
system, he'd still be able to do some of that, right. But you're right, he wouldn't be able to do it
and, you
in
know,
quite the
I
same
would
way.
Just tell Jody, no dribbling. No dribbling, you are allowed to shoot, you are allowed to pass, you are not allowed to drive. It's a rule. We all have rules. Without
you.
Rules, society becomes anarchy.
That's true. All right, who's your three?
Wesley Johnson.
Oh, the shooter.
The shooter.
The guy that Jim Buss identified as...
same interview.
Right, maybe he was just drinking when he said that Kobe would be back
when
for
in
the
Rome.
Preseason. Because he, in the same interview, identified Wesley Johnson as a guy who can come in and shoot and space the floor, which, as we all know, has been the one thing that Wesley Johnson has not been able to do in 3 years in the league.
He also talked about Wesley Johnson. He's like, I think he was the fourth overall pick. Like,
might have been.
It was like he got handed a note card that said Wesley Johnson, and he was just like, huh, the hell is that?
Yeah.
But I think a player of Johnson's inexperience often benefits from playing in a first unit with a little bit more experience, guys like that. And I think
put them around better players,
exactly.
Lesser players play better.
Exactly. Also, too, when you take into account no matter who the starting one and two is, they're going to need some defensive help. And I think along the perimeter, he's possibly their best option.
He is no question. For all the criticism I've laid, it's not on Wesley Johnson as a person. He's a really nice kid. I'm skeptical as to how good he's going to be. I hope he can develop into a rotation player and stick in the league and make something of his, because you don't want to carry that around as being the guy who was the fourth pick in the draft and washed out, not because he was hurt, not because he was a pain in the ass, just because he wasn't very good. That's a tough thing to go through life with. But he is a great, he is as good a defender as they have on the wing. So you're right in that regard. But he's certainly better than who I'm putting at the three. Nick Young. Wes Johnson, much better defender than Nick Young.
Nick Young, better dresser.
Much better. Wes Johnson does not own a purple anything.
No. Nick Young, better interview.
There's a lot of reasons
better
to
hair.
Like him. I just feel like, you know, without Kobe on the floor, you need somebody who can create a shot off the wing, somebody who can both shoot from the perimeter, who you have to honor out there, somebody who can get to the bucket, put the ball on the floor. You need that. Nash, again, you can't rely on him for that anymore. That's definitely not Blake's game in terms of penetrating and scoring at the rim. He does it like three times a year. So I think you have to have Nick Young
that makes sense.
On the floor as
Make
a star.
Absolute sense.
Averaged about 20 points a game as a star, 17 points a game, I think, as a starter over the course of his career. He gives you that.
Sure. And at the four, I've got Jordan Hill.
Same. Absolutely okay. The same.
With Kobe in the lineup, how do things change for you, Brian?
I do one thing. I keep Jordan Hill. You need his offensive rebounding. You need, you know, the ability to get up and down the floor and transition. I keep Steve Blake on the floor. I actually pull Nick Young off, and I play Kobe at the three.
That's interesting, because I'm keeping Steve Nash and Jody Meeks at the one and the two. I'm keeping Wesley Johnson at the three, and I'm making Kobe earn his position back. Kidding. I'm kidding. I would slide Kobe at the three. I think that he would be better suited this year. Coming off injury, I think he's going to have an easier time, relatively speaking, guarding guys a little less quick.
A little bigger, a little slower.
If nothing else, he can blow off some of these assignments and, you know, point to the three as opposed to pointing to the two. Plus, if you want to be able to use Nash, Meeks, Blake, and Farmar in a rotation, then Kobe has to play.
Right, and I think a lot of those spots are going to be sort of semi-interchangeable. Kobe's just got the size to be able to play down and guard threes.
And I would
threes.
Also much rather play Nick Young off the bench.
Yeah, no.
A Nick Young can sometimes go a long way.
Once Kobe's back, it's time to sit Nick Young down. The Nick Young show changes.
Yeah, and he will actually benefit the bench a
lot. Yeah, no, there's no question. They've lacked a guy who, you know, Antoine Jameson was a good scorer off the bench last year, but he's not somebody who creates in the way that you need. You need a wing guy, and he's definitely that. I wrote last week something about Mark Cuban, and obviously we've watched with LA fans have watched with a certain amount of glee him fail to get free agents that he's been angling after for a few years, whether it's Deron Williams, whether it's
Chris
Paul, he was hoping would come available, Dwight Howard. And basically, I've said this before, and I wrote about it again. Don't get too excited when you watch these guys miss, because the Lakers are in a very similar situation, and I happen to think that drawing everybody, you know, the assumption the Lakers are just gonna be able to, you know, pluck guys out of the league once they become free agents and add them to a super roster after the summer of 2014 to me is kind of a fallacy. But I know we've been kind of kicking this around. The whole free agent thing, and I'm skeptical, and I know you have your
concerns. The huge summer of 2014.
All of this stuff, this idea that the Lakers are going to be rebuilt instantly, which is, I think, something that the Lakers...
They don't rebuild, they reload.
I think the Lakers aren't necessarily peddling that narrative, but they're not necessarily doing anything to make you think otherwise. They're not saying, you know, we're going to do what's responsible, we're not going to rush, we're not going to do whatever.
They're allowing the narrative to live.
Right.
Big time.
You know, you look at Cuban as the guy who couldn't sign this guy, and then he goes out and signs Monte Ellis and Jose Calderon, and they haven't totally just torched their cap. They'll be able to go get a max guy next year if they... You know, if they can attract one or whatever. But,
and then Dirk takes his pay cut and yada, yada, yada.
But you've used your cap space, some of your cap space now on Monte Ellis and Jose Calderon, like some significant amounts of it. It may, you know, the big test of Jim Buss coming up isn't going to be, you know, the hire and fire D'Antoni and all this thing. When they get to next summer, it's kind of the first time that he is really going to be in charge of the direction that they go from a personnel standpoint. What kind of splash they make, how aggressive are they going to be, and all these other things. The real test of Jim Buss next year is if things don't shake out, and I don't think LeBron's coming. I'm skeptical about Carmelo Anthony signing him to a more than $100 million contract when he's going to go into his 30s and all these other things. What he chooses not to do, ultimately, as the... end of the line in terms of player personnel decisions, chooses to do and chooses what not to do, will be, I think, the most revealing moment for what kind of executive he is going forward.
There's going to be enormous outward pressure from the fans to make a splash right away. And the one thing that I'm willing to give them some credit in, that they've been an organization that, for better or for worse, and I think fans would argue probably both, depending on the circumstances, have been very willing to ignore it. You know, they have not listened to the fan pressure to fire Mike D'Antoni, whether for Phil Jackson or, at this point,
anyone.
In 2007, when Kobe went on the radio tour and wanted out, they neither traded him nor did they do what Kobe wanted, which was move anybody to bring in either Carlos Boozer or Jason Kidd.
Basically bring in anybody Kobe had heard of.
Right, exactly, which would have made the team a lot worse. It turned out they were right about what they had even before they brought in Pau Gasol. So we've seen evidence of them being willing to take that hit and handle some of that pressure. The other thing, too, that I think is important to remember, and I hope the organization is cognizant of this, is that they don't have to use all of it at once. This is the first time, Brian, in so long that this organization actually has the ability to build the team, relatively speaking, that they want, relatively speaking.
They are limited because they don't have a lot of draft picks at this point.
But I'm saying that they can pull the strings themselves and that they can pick and choose parts and they don't have their moves dictated by trade because they're lacking cap space and the only way they can do it is by exchanging bodies. They've got to be patient and they have to be methodical. And they have to grab guys that they really want, as opposed to names that are going to placate fans. Like I was looking at the list, and I think probably more either early termination option guys that, you know, may or may not opt out, or restricted guys than fans may realize.
Right. The I've said it 1,000 times, and I'll say it 1,000 times more. The list of free agents for the summer of 2014 is so vastly overrated, I cannot begin. When you get past LeBron, who I think will opt out, but then I think we'll end up signing in Miami or Cleveland. I'm like most people, I'm you know, whatever. But, you know, people throw out Paul George. They throw out John Wall. They throw out, I mean, guys like that who I just don't think they're not going to be on the market.
But then, like, I looked at that list, and a name that's restricted but stuck out to me as a potential addition that is realistic was Greg Monroe for Detroit.
Good player.
Very good player, very talented offensive player, still young, still developing on the defensive end, but he's 23 years old. He was basically 16-10 last season. A lot of potential. And with Josh Smith added and Andre Drummond developing, those three in the front court, there have been concerns that offensively they're not going to mesh. And I think there are valid reasons to wonder if
not a lot of floor space.
Exactly.
There.
I could see a situation where the Pistons decide, okay, we're huge on Drummond moving forward. From everything I've read, they love him.
They're great. He's
and
a great player.
Josh Smith, A, is talented, but B, you don't want to move the first franchise guy that you've signed, the first big ticket free agent that you've signed in eons. You don't want to move him right away. So they may decide that they wouldn't move heaven and earth to match anything for Greg Monroe. If the Lakers, say, put out a big offer for Monroe, got him. The Pistons don't match.
It would have to be a max deal.
And leave it at that. If there's nobody else, that's a win moving forward. And they have to treat that like a win.
Because you have a building block. You have a guy, okay, so you say, okay, now we have a 2014 draft pick, whoever it is. Now we have Monroe in the middle. Now you look to 2015.
Right. You bank that space that you have. You don't use it all at once. And you build methodically and sensibly. And if you want proof of how not to do it, look at the way the Knicks have existed since the 99 appearance in the finals, a team that went into decline quickly. They have avoided rebuilding at all costs, and it's really gotten them nowhere. You mentioned Melo. He's been the biggest guy they've signed, and they're worried about him possibly leaving.
You can debate whether or not Monroe will be available. All these other, but your basic premise of patience.
Yeah.
And this gets back to what I was saying before. And the real test, because the D'Antoni hire, the Mike Brown hire, all these things still can be connected in one way, shape, or form with Dr. Buss. Dr. Buss was at least part of that process, whether you think Jim was a bigger part. What Dr. Buss was there. Not getting Dwight back was not a Jim Buss decision. That was a Dwight Howard decision. You could say not firing D'Antoni was a Jim Buss decision. But in terms of constructing the team, we're going into that era where he's going to be that final voice, ultimately the guy who signs the checks. And like I said, what he doesn't do, and I will be very impressed if they go through next summer and it doesn't work the way they want. If you can go out and get Melo and LeBron, great, fine. Love Carmelo if he's next to LeBron. Love anybody if he's next to LeBron. If you can't, though, and he's exercising patience, I will not be the one pounding Jim Buss for not being able to attract.
Nor will I. I'll actually be the one applauding him, probably with you and maybe a few others.
Staying away from guys who are going to be problems going forward.
I hope they recognize the big picture.
All right, Andy. We have reached that point. The part that most people, this Lakers talk at the beginning, they're like, get me to the part where we ask a Kamenetsky, because that's what I want to hear.
Kamenetsky is sweeping the nation.
That's why I show up. That's what I want to see. And it's time, once again, for Ask a Kamenetsky. We've got questions. You've got questions. We've got answers. Andy, first question.
First from Gus2684, at Gus2684, I should say. Would you rather be overweight and have a full head of hair, or average weight and be balding, or fit and completely bald?
The answer to that question, Gus, is simple. It is straightforward. It is the third one. It is fit and completely bald, because as somebody who's been bald for a long time now, going back to my grade school years...
You ever seen pictures of Charlie Brown?
Yeah, I am very comfortable with the shape of my head, with the contours. I think it's a nice round. It's not pinheady or coneheady or blockheady. And I am at this point much more of a fattest than I am a baldist. I don't like the idea of being like really over. I'm not saying I got a little pudge. I got a little pudge. You know, I could lose 5 or 10 pounds. But in clothes, I'm presentable.
In a muumuu, you look terrific.
I am much more concerned about keeping my shapely figure than getting my hair back.
The reason you are right can be summarized in two words, and I say this as somebody also struggling follically, Jason Statham. That's why it's answer C.
All right, next question, the no-look pass. Our man Ray Moralde, great friend of the blog, great blogger himself. Andy, I ask you this question. At Cam Brothers, he says, Never Mind by Nirvana, Licensed to Ill by the Beastie Boys.
This is a really tough call, Brian. You're talking about two outstanding landmark albums that got staying power, both broke ground in their genre in terms of mainstreaming rap or, you know, alternative punk, whatever you want to call it. Nirvana was basically the face of grunge exploding. They both took on taboos, whether you're talking about white rappers in the black world of hip-hop or with Nirvana, drugs, disenchantment, destructive behavior. Both albums
were... Nice alliteration there.
Yeah.
That was good.
Both albums were so huge, Brian, they made members of their band, in particular Adam Yauch with the Beasties or Kurt Cobain with Nirvana, tragically in his case, feel very, very trapped. Kurt Cobain was known to be happy and relieved when Weird Al Yankovic did the parody Smells Like Nirvana, just somebody taking them down a peg. He actually thought it was funny. And I went back and listened to them both, even though I'm very familiar with each. I've listened to them thousands of times.
Creative. Thousands.
I really have. But take
that's
back.
A lot. I'm just saying that's a lot.
Well, one of those albums came out in 87.
That's so true. You've had time. You've had time.
And you can attest, Brian.
We played License Still a lot.
My freshman year alone, I might have hit 1,000 times. That's freshman a lot. Year high. My parents, our parents, Brian.
Same parents.
Have never hated an album more than License to Ill. True story?
It's true.
Creatively, that edge goes to License to Ill, just the range of unusual samples, the styling, them finishing each other's sentences, the storytelling, humor, you know, and when you compare it to their punk roots that came before License to Ill or Paul's Boutique, afterwards was just a masterpiece in production. It's just amazing the boundaries they were pushing. But in terms of resonance, I think that edge goes to Nevermind, and that's where I think that tie ends up broken. Nevermind became this voice of a generation album. It was like the musical version of Catcher in the Rye. Whether Nirvana wanted it to be that way or not, I think they were very uncomfortable with it. That's what it was, and I think in the end, that's what really makes it
It's held in a higher regard.
Exactly.
No question.
Although they're both phenomenal albums.
Next question.
From Keith Kessler. Who has had a better basketball career? Meta World Peace or Lamar Odom?
That is a great question from a guy who has shown that he asks great questions, because Keith Kessler, the first time anybody has appeared twice in Ask a Kamenetsky, if you bring it, we will put you in here.
Unless somebody brings it better.
This is a great question. Both have had outstanding careers, and they're both winding down. In a couple of years, they'll be over. But you know, ultimately, these are two guys who have been very successful in the NBA. But at the same time, are both going to be defined by missed opportunities in one form or another.
Torched opportunities.
Lamar Odom, if you'd have said when Lamar Odom broke in with the Clippers and scored 800 points in his first game, and it was a triple-double in his first game in the NBA, that he would never make an all-star team. And I think it's fair to say he's not going to make an all-star team at this point.
I'm not even sure he's going to be in the league next season.
People would have thought you were insane.
Yeah.
There's no way Lamar Odom will never make an all-star team.
I mean, he looked like the most talented, versatile player since Magic Johnson.
Right. And he's a guy,
like,
whether
just pure natural talent.
Whether in L.A. or Miami or in other places, unfairly, for the most part, was defined as much by what he wasn't than what he was. Everybody looked at him. How can he not be better? How can he not be an all-star? Meanwhile, you know, talking about a guy up until last year, averaged, you know, 14, 15 points a game. And in terms of points and assists and rebounds and the totality of his statistics, is in some incredible company with guys who have filled box scores like that for as long as he has. You look at Meta, who was on his way to being one of the best two-way players in the league, and then the brawl happened. The Palace Brawl, where, you know, just
I've written and talked
there's
about.
There's no way. I mean, that changed the trajectory of his career. He was a good player afterwards, but not what he was before.
I've written and talked about before, Brian. I honestly believe before the brawl, he was on track to potentially have a Hall of Fame career in Meta World.
Very possibly. Very possibly.
He was one of the most dominating two-way players of recent memory. But before that happened, and, you know, he had to, I think, make some adjustments both in terms of what he wanted from his career, what he demanded from it, and also, you know, getting older, health, all that stuff. I'll throw this out there really quickly.
Uh-huh.
Their childhood friend, Elton Brand, who has had the best career of the three of them, because Brand
had the best stretch of being like a premier
player. But for
8 seasons
was basically
right.
20-10 wow. as the focal I, you know, point
I'd have
of
to
a
think,
team.
I'd have
Rock
to really,
solid.
I'd have to think about it because he did have that fall off and he never won anything. You know, Meta's got a title, Lamar's got two. I mean, he was probably at his peak better than, you know, he hit a higher level. But, you know, all three of those guys, now you look at it and you wonder kind of what if Elton doesn't get hurt.
Pretty cool that they all managed to also be teammates in the NBA together.
Think about it. All right, last question from Daniel 0061824. I'm assuming that is not his given name.
A robot.
Yeah, which is cool. I'd like that robots listen to us. I'd like to hear your favorite Dennis Farina moments from his TV and film career. You sound like fans. This is from a Twitter conversation we were all having on Monday following the death of Dennis Farina at age 69.
69 on Monday, he died of a blood clot in his lung.
Great actor.
Yeah.
Your favorite Dennis Farina role or moment?
I'll give you both. moment has got to be in Get Shorty. Fuck you, fuckball.
Greatest. God, that was a great line.
And I was thinking about it. There may be no actor in history better at dropping F-bombs than Dennis Farina. I put that out on Twitter, and a lot of people threw Samuel L. Jackson at me. And Sam Jackson is awesome. He is a master at dropping F-bombs.
First ballot Hall of Famer.
But I think Dennis Farina offered a little more nuance. He was a little less angry at times. He could do it more comedically. He could do it more subtly. He could drop it in at the beginning, at the end. Sam Jackson tends to just go nuclear with the F-bombs. He tends to play it kind of angry at all times. He's also a little more motherfucker than fuck.
Yeah, it's I mean, his role, Ray, it was Ray Bones Barboni in Get Shorty. I think if you went back and you... It's a great movie. It's a really fun movie.
And then
movie.
Best role is, without question, Jimmy Serrano in Midnight Run.
I agree with that. If you went back and you calculated the amount of F-bombs per word, it's actually possible that like up to maybe 20% of his dialogue in Get Shorty were F-bombs, which is incredible. Like every fifth word or fourth word even is an F-bomb. So
actually, one of our tweeps, at Vince Marseille, and we'll make sure to put this on the blog if you want to look at it, sent a link of basically a string of Farina F-bombs. As he said, Farina had awesome...
But it's obviously a great loss. He's a great actor, great on TV. You know, not the best era of Law & Order, but he was still good on it. He could be funny. He could be serious. He was a great actor.
Really missed. Began, by the way, as a cop. A lot of people may not realize this. He was a member of the Chicago PD for, I think, about 17, 20 years. And then through a mutual friend... met Michael Mann, the director, to be an advisor on the movie Thief. And then Michael Mann put him in Manhunter, the earliest incarnation of Silence of the Lambs, and the TV show Crime Story. And the rest, as they say, is history.
So that, Andy, ends Ask a Kamenetsky. I think this was, at worst, the second best edition of Ask a Kamenetsky ever.
And at best, the first.
It's first. I mean, it could be no worse than second. Before we go, quick word on Rudy Gay. Apparently, all of this inefficiency in his career, this lack of shooting prowess, the too much shooting and too much missing, is not because Rudy Gay is some sort of chucker or has, is just not very good at his job. Apparently,
selfish ball hog.
He can't see.
Yeah,
Andy, he can't see.
Yeah, he's been for years resisting wearing contact lenses. He said, quote, "I have a stigma about that stuff. I can't put anything up my nose."
That's good.
I don't know if he knows how to wear contacts, and I can't touch my eyes. You don't put contacts. I've been wearing contacts since I was in like fifth grade.
But he
clarified. I've never put them up through my nose.
No, he clarified. He hadn't added the part about his eyes.
No, I understand that, but I'm just saying it's an odd comment. But he's also got a fear of needles that he got past. So then he got past this. He had surgery on his eyes. He's basically the NBA version of Charlie Sheen's character Ricky Vaughn in Major League, Wild Thing.
We will see. This could be a major boost to the Toronto Raptors this year, who are paying Rudy Gay an awful lot of money, and if all goes well, hope to contend for a lower-tier playoff spot in the East, because only about four teams in the East are actually attempting to make the playoffs this
year.
That, or Toronto's got a chance.
Either that, or he's going to feel really empowered because he can see better, and he's going to shoot even more and make even less.
Wow, look at how clear that rim is. But anyway, I mean, I'm sure if you're in Memphis, you're like, really, Rudy? Really? You were blind, and we were paying you all this money. All right. But
John Hollinger never saw that coming.
So hopefully, low purr for vision attention. Going to the ophthalmologist. Subpar purr. All right. So we'll see what's coming up.
Scouting report, blind as a bat.
Can't see. Who knows what's coming around the bend, Andy? The Lakers still have a roster spot to fill. There's some talk. We'll follow Kobe's rehab. There's lots to do. Lots to do in late July and August in the NBA.
And we'll be there
It's a very fertile time. We'll be there cataloging it all.
We'll think of something.
All right, anything else?
Nope.
All right, see ya.
See ya.